Well, good morning, folks. Judy and Misty, thank you. Thanks for letting us sit in on your conversation last week about what we put down, what we choose to carry on our journeys, particularly on our journeys as they pertain to or embrace what we believe. If you're watching this morning or you're listening to the podcast at another time, if you haven't had a chance to sit with Judy and Misty through their conversation, I would encourage you to check it out, which of course you can do here on the Facebook page. We're also working on getting a podcast version of it up on the website this coming week, and there's a link here on the Facebook page, if that's where you are, to the YouTube version as well, if Facebook isn't a space that you want or like to be in. One of the things that Judy and Misty talked about needing to put down as their beliefs shifted was this value of certainty. And I really resonated with their candid acknowledgement that they both sometimes deeply miss certainty. I've mentioned this to a couple other folks this week in conversation, and there's lots of nodding heads, lots of yep, me toos with that. It can be a very reassuring experience to say, you know, I'm certain about what we believe, and maybe especially about systems of belief that claim to have sort of interlocking and mutually supporting answers to our biggest human questions. On the other hand, if you will, it can be pretty disconcerting to find ourselves in a space where we realize that we are not certain, and that certainty, in the sense of, you know, it can't be any other way, is not a belief system that we can operate in with internal integrity. Judy and Misty both talked a fair bit about the dissonance that they were starting to have in some of their experiences, their lived experiences, and realizing, you know, that's not the space I want to live in. I want to live with internal integrity around these things. So, yes, that can be disconcerting. It can also be very freeing to not have to keep on trying to convince ourselves or others of something that we know, when we're honest with ourselves, that we know we no longer believe, or that we might even say we believe or give lip service to, but if we really check in, we kind of go, nope, you know what, that's, I don't hold that in any deep place that I would call core belief. And that freedom, among other things, was part of the gift residing in what Judy and Misty shared. Because if you saw that, if you got to watch that and sit in on it, what we were having was a living encounter with people we know that are leaning into that freedom to explore uncertainty and all. And that's different than reading a book about uncertainty. I'm not saying greater or lesser, but it is unique. And I think there's a kind of human heartening about it. We're encouraged, we're given courage in our own exploration by being with others who have been there, who are there. Now, living in a space where we acknowledge that there are big questions for which we don't have ironclad answers can sometimes bring us face to face with having to take our own responsibility for how we handle that. We can't hand it off to the facts. We can't hand it off to the data. We can't hand it off to the authorities. We can't hand it off to the experts. That we have to take responsibility for how we handle that. And one of the reasons I think that can be challenging is because sometimes having a non-negotiable belief system can provide a robust feeling framework when we're taking on big challenges. So, for example, it can help us to feel courageous or hopeful when it might not seem reasonable to do so. So if our journey takes us exploring in directions other than that, we may need to give some energy to trying to figure out how to live well in a less well-defined space when it comes to what we believe. To live well in a space that doesn't have, that's not so hegemonic, that doesn't have a big fence of maybe dogma or right belief around it, for example, or right behaviors, you know, boundary markers for in-groups and out-groups in terms of right belief, that kind of thing. A couple of weeks ago, Free Press writer Jen Zarate cited a consumer psychologist. As I was writing this, I was like, we have consumer psychologists? Well, of course we do. Of course we do. Anyway, she cited this consumer psychologist named Kate Nightingale. And the citation was Nightingale's observation that, quote, the COVID-19 pandemic has greatly increased the mortality salience, the awareness that we will die, of consumers. Mortality salience. No one gets out alive, is what that fancy phrase means. As Nightingale explains in Zarate's article, when this happens, when our mortality salience goes up, we tend to behave in one of two ways. Either we become more moral and pro-social, helping others and increasing our own internal sense of integrity, or we become more impulsive. Quote, these two effects are not necessarily exclusive. During the pandemic, they appear to have come in waves. Once we feel we have acted morally for a while, we might have a period of impulsiveness. Impulse buying, she's a consumer psychologist, remember, impulse buying is rewarded in the brain by a hit of dopamine and is often associated with dealing with extreme emotions. This is what we mean by retail therapy. Close quote. You've probably heard the saying, when the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. That's basically what Nightingale is talking about. Ways we cope when our experience of the world is swimming in uncertainty. In her quote, Nightingale does something that many of us do when we're trying to illustrate a point. She offers a contrast. She offers an either or. It's what I was referring to in the blurb when I talked about on switch, off switch beliefs. She says it this way in the quote, when we're more aware of our mortality, we tend to behave in one of two ways. Right? That's that on switch, off switch. Now, as a teaching, you know, learning device, that kind of contrasting can be pretty helpful. It can stir up our thinking. It can get us examining our world and our own lives. However, it also often comes with a built-in problem, which is that it pushes away nuance and complexity. Which is why I really appreciated that Nightingale went on to say in that quote, the two effects are not necessarily exclusive. And then she kind of goes right back to either or illustrating after saying that, but at least the door gets opened. Now, why do I think this is so important when it comes to exploring what we believe? There's lots of ways we could look at that. But for today, I want to suggest that it's important because we live out of what we believe. We don't always do it consciously or deliberately, but we always do it. We're operating out of something when we function in real time, in the real world. And because we, us humans, are the ones making worlds of this earth, we are the ones that are making societies and cultures out of the raw material of our home, of the planet, of the earth. And because that's our job here, if you will, what we believe and how we handle those beliefs doesn't just impact us. It impacts everyone around us. It impacts the way things happen between us. It impacts the way things happen between us as a species and the planet, the earth. So it has a lot of impact, is the point. And, you know, if living out of what we believe has that kind of impact, and all we have to do is glance at the evening news or at pick a Twitter feed to see that either or thinking is not serving us very well, then it's probably a good idea to examine that and probe it and explore it. Could think about it this way. It can be pretty hard to stay in the game when it comes to playing a part in making a better world, especially around the big stuff, right? We've just been talking about the pandemic. I think that qualifies as big stuff. But I'm also thinking of things like systemic breakdown, systemic racism, poverty, homelessness, climate change, food insecurity, and so on. Those are the kind of things they could just feel, they can, as issues, they can just feel too big to even try, you know? Because I mean, really, like, where do you start, you know? And so sometimes we get stuck. And one of the reasons it can be hard to get unstuck on this kind of thing is because we are so surrounded by, so influenced by, so submerged in either or thinking. I don't know if you've ever seen this. It does go back a couple of years, but in the early Star Wars movie, The Empire Strikes Back, Yoda has what has become a famous line where he says, "Do or do not. There is no try." Tempted to try to do it in Yoda voice, but I'm just going to let that go. If you've never even seen the movie, you've probably, you know, heard that referenced as sort of a pop culture thing, or you've seen it somewhere online. Do or do not. There is no try. In our culture, most of us have been influenced in myriad ways to think either or. Pass, fail, do not. In the realm of spiritualities and religion in particular, believe, don't believe. I mean, just switch your radar on for the language of believer, unbeliever, and keep it on for a week. If you're in any settings where there are religious folks communicating with one another, and watch for that one. Two categories of humans, believers, unbelievers, right? It'll show up right away. Act morally or be impulsive, to reference Nightingale's material from earlier. Either a part of the solution or a part of the problem. On switch, off switch. So when we're confronted with the kind of problem where it's hard to imagine how we could make any difference at all, something that feels just intransigent to us, like it's not going to move no matter how hard we push on it, we might be tempted to just not engage. Maybe in order to consider how we could face a challenge like that, we need a mindset that's less like Yoda and more like the one Taylor Swift talks about in her song, This Is Me Trying. There's a person in that song. It's a story song, like lots of Taylor Swift songs are. And the person in that song is kind of a mess. But they're not a total mess. They are, as the lyric tells us, they are feeling sad enough to drive to the edge of a cliff and watch their tears fall over the edge, but they aren't following their sadness over the brink. Sometimes they're indulging in self-destructive behavior, but then again, sometimes they pull out of it and they talk to someone about what's distressing them. The last chorus of that song says, "And I just wanted you to know that this is me trying. Maybe I don't quite know what to say. I just wanted you to know that this is me trying. At least I'm trying." And just in case you're not part of Taylor Nation, or you feel like, you know, pop song lyrics kind of categorically lack gravitas, let me offer another example. Martin Luther King Jr., towering figure in the history of the fight against anti-black racism, a hero in that struggle, but for sure not someone that you would call a morally flawless person. A deeply flawed hero, to use, you know, a common phrase. In other words, a pretty ordinary person in lots of ways. King once preached a sermon in which he offered his own reflections arising from his heightened sense of mortal salience. And when I read this now, it sounds almost eerily prescient. But I think in context, it was neither more nor less than the thoughtful reflections of someone who had the maturity to look around at life experience and suggest, you know, or observe rather, as we did a moment ago, that no one gets out of this alive. Mortality salience. Anyway, this is what he had to say. "Every now and then, I think about my own death, and I think about my own funeral. Every now and then, I ask myself, what is it that I want said? I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. And I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those that were naked. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Is it okay for me to be envious of King's cadences? What a powerful communicator. In his inimitable and enviable cadences, King is pointing toward that complexity that I've been exploring a little bit this morning. And he's doing it, as he was inclined to, by pointing us toward a Jesus story. And in particular, a passage in Matthew 25 that Bible editors often title The Sheep and the Goats. And I don't know if you're a Bible reader or not, but if you are, it's worth observing and paying attention to the fact that the headers are not part of the translation of the texts that have survived for so long. They are the work of editors, and so helpful, but also kind of not translation so much as just full-blown interpretation. And that's that can be important when we're coming to those texts and saying, what's the lesson for me here? Anyway, that text, Matthew 25, is the text where Martin Luther King Jr. gets all of that fed me when I was hungry, clothed me when I was naked, visited me in prison language from. That's the language of that text, and that's what he's referring to. Now, sheep and goats. You don't need a lit degree to figure out that sheep and goats is code for either or, right? Anyway. And if you read the story itself, you'd find that the binary nature of that image is immediately reinforced in the story with the imagery of right hand, left hand. So again, either or, right? But the story is about a lot more than on switch, off switch thinking. This is a story that contains one of those moments where Jesus says something that is at least as well known as the Yoda quote. In terms of cultural stickiness, it's been around for a long time, when he says, whatever you did for the least of the people, you did for me. I mean, if nothing else, we have another towering figure in history, a Mother Teresa, you know, for whom that care for the so-called least of these is a centerpiece. We can't do any great things, but we can do small things with great love. You know, that kind of an idea. Now, the story that precedes Jesus saying, whatever you did for the least of the people, you did for me, is a judgment story. It's framed as a moment of judgment, a moment where the characters in the story find out they either did the right things or they didn't do the right things, either or. And as the story is laid out, those appear to be the only two options. You did the right thing or you didn't. You're a sheep or you're a goat. You go in the right-hand bin or you go in the left-hand bin. And that's the structure of the story. I'm not going to get into this a lot, but if you're intrigued by these things, it's worth noting that Jesus, of course, is a Jewish rabbi, and that the Jewish mind around grouping is fairly precise at this point in history. There are only two kinds of humans in Jewish thought at this point. There are Jews and everyone else. Gentiles is the word for that. There are lots of tribes, but there are only two kinds of tribes. Tribes who have true belief and tribes who have untrue belief. There are lots of gods, but only two kinds. There's one kind that's true, all the others are not true. And that's sort of the way the entire sort of lens, or the dominant lens through which the stories are told and the way the world is viewed. And so hardly a surprise to find that the king character in this story functions that same way, right? They're sorting people into two piles, and there's not a lot of nuance to the structure of that. Now, as we considered earlier, either or, on switch, off switch, right hand, left hand, sheep, goats, that's a great rhetorical device in the sense that it's crisp, it is to the point, and it can be very motivational. some of you are finding my reference to this text probably triggering because it was used as motivational in your life in a way that that produced fear rather than joy, that produced anxiety about the nature of the divine rather than a sense that there might be something good and loving there to lean into. And so this is just one of those stories that says either you get it right and you end up in the live forever bin, or you get it wrong and you end up in the burn forever bin. And that's all the story means. And I'm here to challenge that. So hopefully you haven't bailed, already. But if you needed to, I get it. Anyway, great rhetorical device because it does those kinds of things, right? Because it can make us just like get our head up and kind of freak out about something, pay attention to it, focus on it, make a decision about it. Change their behavior around something, the things that, that communicators have been known to try to help people to do. Anyway, but here's the thing. Despite the insistence of that rhetorical device in the structure of the story, there is something going on in the human characters in the story, the people the story's about, that doesn't fit with that. And this is the thing. In that story, both the did it and the didn't do it characters of the story have a response that reveals that it's not that simple. When the king in the story pronounces judgment, when he says you're in this bin or you're in that bin, both those who are said to have been helpful to others and those who haven't been helpful to others are completely baffled by the judgment that the king is offering. They both don't understand why that framework is being used. And it seems to me that they have both missed the same point. And the point is that caring for others is not an on-off switch, but that trying matters. And that trying can look an awful lot like ordinary life. That simply being kind to someone, that offering help in everyday ways. I mean, the illustrations are so accessible in this story at many points as to be banal. Offering someone a drink of water, offering someone a jacket when they're chilly, reaching out to connect with the disconnected, including those who are systemically disconnected. That's the in prison part of things, Ordinary human to human interactions. That this kind of caring matters so much. It has so much weight in the mystery of how the cosmos, how the universe, how love, how God functions, that it can change everything. That's what neither we did the right thing people nor we didn't do the right thing people seem to grasp. That's the point they've missed in the story, is that trying actually alters things of that magnitude. To me, the complex and heartening idea in this story is that it's not the magnitude of the action that matters. It's that we didn't look at the magnitude of the problem and do nothing. It's not the magnitude of our actions that matters so much as that we don't look at the magnitude of the problem and do nothing. It's worth remembering, I think, that in the Matthew story, the people who are praised for their actions are a bunch of folks who basically showed up and said, "We don't really understand how this works, but this is us trying." To which the wise teacher essentially says, "Now you're getting it. Well done." Peace.